So an odd topic tonight in some ways, something I call the teaching. And this is kind of a perspective that I've developed over the years. And as I was thinking about this talk, I realized it comes from a few different sources. In part, it comes from reflections on Buddhism and Taoism, the universal nature of Dharma, the law of karma in Buddhism, the flow of the Tao. That's one strand. It also comes from my studies in energetic healing and my experiences in transformational healing and the nature of that. And the language itself comes from Kaf. Kaf is a group, C-A-F-H, Kaf. And I was actually a member of this group for 20 years. It is a South American spiritual path centered on meditation. No one has ever heard of it. It's much bigger in Latin America than it is here. But the actual language, Kaf talked about the teaching. And every week in Kaf, we would get teaching notes. And those notes were incredible. But it was always clear, anything printed on the page is not the teaching, you know? And so, in some sense, the language has been inspired by Kaf, although I'm using the word teaching in a slightly different way than Kaf uses it. And so, what do I mean by the teaching? First of all, in some sense, it's easier to say what it's not. Right now, I'm talking in words. My talking in words is not the teaching, you know. The teaching is not something that one human being can communicates to another via words. It's not a verbal content. If in any conversation, the teaching opens up for one of the people in the conversation, I would say that is a kind of act of grace, and that's not something that not something that any one human being controls or gets to claim credit for. I'll also say that to some extent, even understanding the teaching, it's hard given our culture, which is so head-centered, so verbal-centered. There's this conceit that the strategic mind should be able to understand anything, and that anything worthwhile, you should be able to state it in words and write a book about it, you know, that kind of thing. And admittedly, there's all kinds of sophisticated academic topics about which there are books, and you can read books about them and learn from books, you know, that sort of thing. But for example, if I didn't have any sense of humor, there's no way I could just read a book and at the end of that book have a vibrant sense of humor, you know? If I were not connected to my passion, there's no way I could read a book and suddenly at the end of that book be a passionate lover, you know? And if I'm living a life that is meaningless, I'm not going to read a book and just through means of that book suddenly have this experience of the world being full of vibrant meaning, you know. There's so many things in life, we don't get them through a book. We don't get them verbally. We have to live our way into them. There's a fantastic quote by Rilke. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign language. Do not seek the answers, which cannot be given to you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Then, perhaps gradually, without noticing it, you will live along some distant day into the answer. And so that quote captures a little about the teaching. There are times when, say, a relatively shallow or relatively lightweight teaching, you know, I might receive it and it might just be a shift in perspective. And very quickly it percolates up to the head and I can say, oh yeah, I get it. You know, I never looked at it that way. Oh no, it makes total difference if I look at it this way, you know. So every once in a while there is a teaching that is a more lightweight thing, and it's relatively quickly that it percolates up to the head because it's not that deep. The more potent teachings are the ones that we struggle with. The ones we struggle with for a period in life. The ones we wrestle with, the ones that drive us crazy, and we go to sleep with that problem. We wake up the next day with that problem, and it for a period in life, we're just wrestling with that particular problem. That is the teaching. Often it comes to us in the form of trauma. It comes to us in the form of trauma because we don't realize how deeply we're attached. We don't realize how deeply we're attached to a certain belief, to a certain way of being, to a certain defense. And so when something comes in disrupts that belief or that defense, we experience it as trauma because we didn't realize how tight we were holding on, you know. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, is clinging. And of course, in a moment of trauma, we're not really ready to assimilate anything. You know, we're in that moment when we're in shock and in pain and full of defense and that sort of thing. We're not ready to assimilate. And it's only through going through a healing process that we're able to integrate and then live with that wisdom. And it's usually only at the end of that, after we've gone through all the struggle, after it's done already, then we're in a place where we can talk about it. It kind of percolates up to the head last, you know. And it's an interesting thing to think about healing in this perspective, you know. Ego has this story, you know, here's the word healing, and you know, such a lovely word. And ego thinks, well, healing means, you know, I can stop feeling the bad things that I don't want to feel, and I can feel more of the good stuff that I do want to feel. You know, that's how ego likes to frame me. You know, ego likes to frame the nature of healing. What if the purpose of healing really is to allow us to assimilate the teaching? You know? And so the deeper teachings are the ones that occupy a phase of our life. And in some sense, the deepest teachings are the soul lessons, the things that we wrestle with throughout our whole incarnation. Often those are linked to early childhood trauma, which you know, lays the groundwork for the furthest reaching patterns in our life. And I'll say also that I'm talking about the teaching in a very traumatic form, and it is sometimes, you know, often the teaching does enter our life in a rather shocking form. You know, there's that, a few weeks ago we talked about the Bagua and the initial Bagua, the arousing, the shocking sign of thunder. And Confucius said, God comes forth in the sign of the arousing. You know, that there's this way that the teaching comes in a shocking manner. But it's also possible that we receive the teaching that the shock is more one that inspires curiosity and wonder, maybe even laughter. It depends on, you know, how tightly we're holding on in life. You know, if our second chakra and first chakra are really clenched very tight, then the shocks are going to come as trauma, you know. But if we're more able to flow with it, it may be that we're... the shock, we can integrate the shock at another level, and it may be a cause, say, for more curiosity and wonder. And so there is a universal nature to the teaching, and it's fascinating that almost at, you know, regardless of what vibration I'm living at, and regardless of how completely self-absorbed and selfish or sage-like wide open, I'm going to be experiencing the teaching in some way. There's a profound quote from the Tao Te Ching. This is from the first page of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu. As the origin of heaven and earth, Tao is nameless. As the mother of all things, it is named. So, as ever hidden, we should look to its inner essence. As always manifest, we should look to its outer aspects. These two flow from the same source, though differently named. And so, what I take from that is, let's say I was living a very selfish life. I was a selfish, insensitive, aggressive person. And I'm going through the world and I'm stepping on people's toes and insulting people. And of course, the reaction I would be naturally getting is people would be defensive, they'd be insulting me, they'd be fighting back against me, and I'd be encountering all this resistance from the world. You know, why are people giving me a hard time when I give them a hard time? You know, like this kind of thing. And in all that resistance, that would be the teaching I'd be receiving, you know? Now, contrary, if I'm in a place of kindness, patience, love, if I'm treating people with tremendous compassion, then I'm gonna experience much more. I'm gonna experience their generosity, their openness, this sort of thing. And I'm experiencing the teaching around that, but I'm experiencing it in a different way. I'm experiencing much more ease because I'm more aligned with that deeper teaching. Then, of course, there are other layers, you know, then I may be kind and then there are people who are still rude to me even when I'm kind to them. And, you know, then that's a whole other layer of, you know, being compassionate even to the people that don't return compassion. So as a general rule, the places in our life where we're feeling vibrant and there's a tremendous amount of ease, those are teachings we've integrated. Maybe we learned them in this life. Maybe we've worked hard to integrate them in previous lives. Who's to say, you know? And the places where we struggle, those are the teachings we're working on. And sometimes it happens that I'm at ease in a place of life for a while, and then suddenly it gets hard, you know? And it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily doing anything wrong or I've gotten worse, you know? The universe has decided that it's time for me to work on the next level of the teaching. You know, I'm working on, as it were, the advanced course at that point, you know. We have all these stories when we hit a time of struggle, like, you know, what did I do wrong? Or there's something wrong with me, or someone out there doesn't like me. What if struggle actually means we're being gifted with entry to a higher form of the teaching? And we're working on deeper lessons at this point. There's an amazing quote from Mencius. Mencius is the, he's a Confucian. He's the number two guy in the Confucian tradition. He's, in China, he's called the second sage. He's really the man that brought a heart quality to the entire Confucian tradition. He's rather amazing. But one of his quotes is, "So it is that whenever heaven invests a person with great responsibility, it first tries his resolve, exhausts his muscles and bones, starves his body, leaves him destitute, and confounds his every endeavor. In this way, his patience and endurance are developed, and his weakness is overcome." And this whole idea that when you're experiencing challenges, it doesn't necessarily mean you've done anything wrong or that you're a failure or something's wrong, it may be that you're being challenged to step up to the next level. And that is part of the teaching. I think the mystery of the teaching is the way that it is woven through the vast fabric of human experience. And what I mean by that, Take a very large event. Say, you know, 20 years ago, there was the tragedy of 9/11. 3,000 people died. Millions of people were affected by that. There were the people that lost loved ones or multiple loved ones. There were people that worked on the wounded. There are people who were eyewitnesses. I mean, that was an incredibly powerful teaching to see these events unfold before your eyes. And of course, all of us saw videos of it, and it was impactful for all of us. And I think the mystery is that even though that was an objective historical event, each one of us sees it through our own lens. and each one of us receives the individual teaching that we need from that general event. There's a kind of mystical understanding that not only does everyone gets kind of what they need from that experience, and there's ultimately tremendous healing that comes through that. I remember seeing this tiny little article, and this was a few months after 9/11, and someone had just written this article entitled "Compassion Trumps Violence at Ground Zero," and they're just talking about the tremendous outpouring of love and caring that had taken place in New York City, and caring for all the victims and caring for the bereaved, and the way that the city people rallied around each other, and that there was actually much more love that resulted than the actual violence. But of course, the violence is what makes the newspapers, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's something to think about. The tragedies and the big losses, that those are the eye-catching things. But is that the deepest truth? I think in some ways the most humbling part of the teaching is that even when I fail, even when I'm at my worst moment and I say something horrible or I do something horrible, the mystery is that that lands as a teaching in somebody else's life. And even the moments that I completely regret and I have guilt about and shame about, of course, that's my teaching to work, process through all that, the guilt and the shame and everything else. But beyond all my control, the teaching lands through my agency. There's something very humbling I find about that. So I'm going to share a passage. Actually, at this point, I'll share the quote sheet. Oops. Let's see. I have to get that link. Okay, there's the quote sheet. And I have this long passage from T.S. Eliot. It was actually hard narrowing it down because there's a lot that T.S. Eliot says in the Four Quartets that's relevant to the teaching. But he said, "There is, it seems to us at best, only a limited value in the knowledge derived from experience. The knowledge imposes a pattern and falsifies, for the pattern is new in every moment, and every moment is a new and shocking valuation of all we have been. We are only undeceived of that which deceiving could no longer harm. In the middle, not only in the middle of the way, but all the way, in a dark wood, in a bramble, on the edge of a grim pen, where there is no secure foothold, and menaced by monsters, fancy lights, risking enchantment, do not let me hear of the wisdom of old men, but rather of their folly, their fear of fear and frenzy, their fear of possession, of belonging to another, or to others, or to God. The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless." So there's a lot I like in that passage. First of all, the fact that the knowledge that we have, the knowledge does impose a pattern, and that pattern is not necessarily going to be true to everything that arises. And then that line, "We are only undeceived by that which deceiving could no longer harm us." In other words, if it can still harm us, it's still deceiving us. And it's only when we completely overcome that, all right, then I can see through that illusion, you know. And I love the thing about, do not let me hear the wisdom of old men, but where they were really wrestling with life, where they're wrestling with fear, where they're wrestling with, you know, what it is to belong to others. Something very raw and real about that. And the deepest teachings are along those lines. So in the quote sheet, I have the Lao Tzu and the Mencius. The Buddha also said, "We do not learn by experience, but by our capacity for experience. Wow. A quote from the Zen master Joshu. In this life, if I meet an old person of 80 or 90 experienced in the Dharma who needs to learn something from me, I will teach. And if a young girl is 7 who has something to teach me, I will sit at her feet and learn. And so something just, again, about that humility, about, you know, at any place, I am willing to learn. That is a profound attitude to have toward the teaching. The Rilke quote I already read. Picasso said, I am always doing that which I cannot do in order that I may learn how to do it. And I think right there we have the secret of Picasso's greatness. How did he become one of the greatest artists in the world? He was always doing what he could not do, you know. Henry Miller said, usually what is taught in school must be unlearned. Life is the teacher. The author James Thurber said, all human beings should try to learn before they die what they are running from and to and why. William Syaran said, try to learn to breathe deeply, to taste food when you eat, and when you sleep, really to sleep. Try as much as possible to be wholly alive with all your might. When you laugh, laugh like hell. When you get angry, get good and angry. Try to be alive. You will be dead soon enough. I think that probably should be soon. Ajahn Chah said, we practice to learn letting go, not to increase our holding on. Enlightenment appears when you stop wanting anything. The psychologist Leo Buscaglia said, it is a paradox that many educators and parents still differentiate between a time for learning and a time for play without seeing the vital connection between them. And that's true for children, but it's also true for us. Can we truly engage in life with a spirit of playfulness and invite the teaching with play? Ram Dass says, at first you will think of your practice as a limited part of life. In time, you will realize everything you do is part of your practice. And it's true, our entire life is giving us the teaching at any moment. Mary Oliver said, this is the first, wildest, and wisest thing I know, that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attention. And it's so profoundly true that the quality of our attention shapes so significantly the quality of the world we experience. The thing we call the world shifts radically depending on how we pay attention to it. Nature Ryomi Remen says, life offers its wisdom generously. Everything teaches. Not everyone learns. Mary Catherine Bateson says, we are not what we know, but what we are willing to learn. You know, and it's a fascinating question. What are you willing to learn about life? What are you willing to learn about yourself? Muji said, if you are curious, you will learn. If you are desperate, you will discover. And sometimes it takes life, you know, life is generous, but sometimes life just has to push us into a corner where we feel we have no choice. And that's the only place where we're willing to discover what we need to learn. And David White, the poet, said, strangely, every person lives out their destiny no matter what they do, according to the way they shape the conversation, but that destiny may be lived out at the level of consummation or complete frustration through an experience of homecoming or a distant sense of exile, or more likely some gradation along the spectrum that lies between. It is still our destiny, our life, but the sense of satisfaction involved and the possibility of fulfilling its promise may depend on a brave participation, a willingness to hazard ourselves in a difficult world, a certain form of wild generosity with our gifts, a familiarity with our own depths, our own discovered surprising breaths, and always a long practice and robust vulnerability equal to what the future may offer.